All right, guys, you are locked on Falcons. I am your host, Aaron Freeman, and today we are wrapping up the 2017 Falcons roster review by talking quarterbacks and that beloved position that matters the most in this world, special teams.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily podcast on the Atlanta Falcons, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
All right, guys. I am your host, Aaron Freeman, founder of FalFans.com, one of the longest-running Falcon fan sites on the internet, of course, hosting this podcast. Feeling a little bit under the weather, starting to get the beginnings of a cold. Hopefully, it won't be too disruptive this week as we record many, many episodes and continue to chug along this offseason. This is part six of our roster review. Originally, it was supposed to be five parts. In which we broke down every position group on the Falcons. But due to the length, so far you've gotten a little bit over 5 hours of content. This will probably push it to about 6 hours of content, really sort of going deep into the Falcons roster, who's good, who's bad, and really getting a deeper assessment of sort of where they're headed going into this 2018 offseason and my perception of maybe the direction that they'll go in this offseason. So laying that foundation of knowledge and whatnot that we can sort of figure out as we get closer to March and April in free agency and the draft of exactly how the Falcons want to address their roster. So let's jump right into this, talking cornerbacks. Not to start off too much sounding like a film snob, but I do think one of the shortcomings of watching a football game on television is, in particular when it comes to the secondary, you're missing a lot of the action. And I think because of this, you know, sort of the perceptions surrounding cornerbacks and wide receivers in particular, I think people tend to overrate how good wide receivers are just because of the way that the television shows the game. And I also think people tend to underrate how good cornerbacks are. And, you know, I always say this, but from time to time, cornerbacks are going to get beat. You know, over the course of your average NFL football game, a team is going to have 21 completions for each team. So, you know, 42 passes on average are going to get completed every single Sunday in every single game. And I think because of that, you know, someone is going to have to catch those passes and someone's going to have those passes catched. Caught on them, can't speak. And so that's part of the reason why I say wide receivers tend to get a little bit overrated and cornerbacks tend to get a little bit underrated. And I think because the cornerbacks have the disadvantage of the only time you really ever see a cornerback in coverage when you're watching on television is when he's getting beat. And you look at the numbers and, you know, on average, you know, I think typically even an elite cornerback is only going to maybe break up, you know, one, maybe two passes a game. And over the course of an entire secondary, that may be three, maybe four, maybe five passes a game. And, you know, that's far being outweighed by the number of completions that cornerbacks tend to give up. And I say all this sort of as a preface, because I think it does lead people to have an overly exaggerated negative opinion of cornerbacks. And in particular, we see this, when it comes to the Falcons cornerbacks. We saw it last year with Robert Alford. We're seeing it this year with Desmond Trufant. And I say all this because I'm just not, instead of spending today trying to, you know, debunk misconceptions about our players as I've done in some of the other positional reviews, I'm just going to be like, yeah, if you don't think Alford was good last year, if you didn't think Trufant was good this past year, then you don't know what you're talking about. And that's it. I'm just going to be dismissive of those opinions. So if you know anybody or if you happen to believe that, just, you know, take it from me. You're wrong. And just move on with your life. You know, and again, I think if you think they're bad, then you're just missing a significant portion of the game from just watching it live on television. You know, I don't think there's really an end-all, be-all metric that you can look at for cornerbacks like you can for several other positions where it's sort of like the one glaring metric that sort of stands out that we can judge all cornerbacks by. I think you can look at several. I mean, passer rating is one, probably the primary one that most people would look at, passer rating allowed at least. But I also look at completion percentage allowed. I look at targets per snap, yards per snap, yards per target, and sort of passes defenses per target. And I think all these metrics sort of paint a broader picture and a more complete picture of a cornerback skill set. And so some guys will do well in all the categories, some guys will do poorly in all the categories, and some guys will do well in some of them, but not so much in other ones. And I think you need to have that broad portrait painted for you before you become too judgmental. You know, we can take a guy like Trufant, for example, right off the bat. Many would argue he had a down year, and without having access to multiple years of data, Pro Football Focus is, or at least my access to Pro Football Focus's metrics only go back to 2016 and to compare his data. So I can't say for sure, but I would probably say that, you know, in a lot of these metrics, based off of my memory of what Trufant's production was in prior years, that, you know, 2017 probably was one of his worst seasons in terms of certain metrics and categories that you would measure his play by, but not certainly all. You look at his completion rate allowed and the yards per snap allowed this year, and he was better in those two categories this year than he was a year ago. You also look that he was targeted a lot less on a per snap basis this year versus last year. And so with teams avoiding him, you know, despite that fact, he gave up a relatively high amount of yards per target and a high passer rating. And I think a lot of that was due to him getting beat for a number of big plays and also getting beat for a couple more touchdowns than we're sort of used to seeing. So again, I think in some ways it was a down year for Trufant, but in other ways it wasn't. And I think, you know, either regardless of whether you want to call this a down year, I think most of the metrics indicate that Trufant still had a very good season, just maybe not the elite of the elite seasons that we've seen him have in previous years. You look at the top 124 cornerbacks in the league based off of Pro Football Focus metrics, looking at snap counts, who participated in at least 25% of their team snaps. So that's basically, you know, the starters and the nickel guys and a couple of number four corners that got some playing time due to injuries. Trufant finished ninth best in the league in terms of the percentage of snaps where he was targeted, meaning opposing quarterbacks rarely went after him, thanks in large part to the reputation he's built up over the last, what, 5 years, 4 years. And when they did go after him, he contested a high percentage of those throws, finishing 21st in the league in terms of the percentage of his targets that resulted in pass deflections. You also look at Robert Alford. He was targeted way more than Trufant was as a result of how often teams were avoiding Trufant, as he finished 73rd in the league in terms of the percentage of snaps where he was thrown at. However, Alford gave up a lower completion rate than Trufant did, better passer rating than Trufant did, and was only slightly behind Trufant in terms of the number of contested throws that he had, ranking 30th. And notably, when you look at the Falcons and you look at, like, to say the top 32 cornerbacks among those 124 in terms of their ranking of contested throws, the Falcons were one of a handful of teams that had both of its starting quarterbacks in that top 32. Now, unfortunately, only a few of those contested throws resulted in interceptions for the Falcons. Between Alford and Trufant, they only had three picks this year. Had one or two more that I think were wiped out by penalty. But, you know, I think interceptions are often sort of an indicator of being in the right place at the right time. So they're kind of random, but certainly you can increase the chances of you picking off more passes if you're contesting more throws. I've said multiple times on this podcast over the last several months that I think the Falcons' secondary is the strength of their defense and arguably the biggest strength of their team. I think their ability to sort of man up other teams' receivers and the fact that I was able to go through most of the season not overly concerned with the opposing wideouts, I think is a testament to the abilities of both Alford and Trufant. It's really only the elite of the elite receivers, the Mike Evanses of the world, the Antonio Brown caliber receivers that really give me a lot of pause. I know bigger wide receivers like Kelvin Benjamin and Michael Thomas have been a little bit more problematic for our cornerbacks than others. But it's basically like you have to be on that level or like a 6'4" guy for me to be overly concerned about you. That was one of the reasons why I was a little bit more concerned about Alshon Jeffrey, you know, having a big game in that playoff game than I normally would have been, just because of his size advantage that he has over our guys who are about average size for NFL corners. You know, I think our ability to sort of match up on the back end is really sort of drives how good this defense is and how good this pass defense is. And I think, you know, I've said before that I do think the pass rush and the play of the front seven sort of is what indicates when we play well defensively. However, I think that's because the foundation upon which that's built is because of the good play in the secondary. So consistently week to week, you're going to get really strong secondary play from the Falcons. It's the front seven that's been a little bit more up and down, particularly the pass rush and the run defense. And when those guys are playing at a high level, you know the Falcons defense is going to be great because the secondary is very reliable. And then when those guys aren't playing particularly well, you know, the defense is a little bit more suspect, even when the secondary is pretty reliable. So that's how I would sort of term it. If you look at the overall pass defense, and one of the metrics that you would use most often to indicate quality pass defense, because it correlates the most to winning among stats, is defensive passer rating. The Falcons gave up a defensive passer rating of 92, which was 22nd best in the league. But I think some of that is due to the high number of completion percentage that they gave up this year and the very low number of interceptions they picked off. You know, they wound up finishing 8th in the NFL in yards per attempt allowed, 8th in terms of the percentage of pass attempts that went for 20-plus yard gains. So they certainly weren't giving up big plays this year. I also saw that they were 5th in the entire NFL in terms of the adjusted net yards per attempt allowed in the red zone. Adjusted net yards per attempt, Anya, to shorten it, is basically next to, if not slightly better than, passer rating in terms of a stat that correlates to winning. So giving up a low on Anya in the red zone is certainly very advantageous, and I think a big reason why the Falcons were a top 5 red zone defense. You look at the 4 teams that were better than the Falcons in terms of Anya in the red zone. They were Baltimore, Jacksonville, Minnesota, and the Chargers. And I don't think it's a coincidence that those were the top 4 teams that also finished atop the league in defensive passer rating as well. So certainly, that should indicate that the Falcons truly have a sort of a top 5 pass defense, but certainly didn't necessarily play to that level in a lot of ways. And I think one of the reasons why that was, and why the Falcons were lagging a little bit in certain metrics in terms that indicated really how good their pass defense was this year, may be due to the play of their nickel cornerback in Brian Poole. And we'll certainly talk a little bit more about Brian Poole as you guys stay right here on the Locked On Falcons podcast. As many of you guys know, I was a big advocate of the team keeping Jalen Collins on the roster throughout from August as well as in December. And a lot of that had to do with, particularly when it came to August, a lot of that had to do with my sort of skepticism and lack of trust in sort of Brian Poole's ability to sort of hold up in the man-heavy scheme that the Falcons often employ. But I do think, looking back on the 2017 season, I thought Poole did more than hold his own. I was very concerned heading into the season, but the Falcons facing some slot receivers like Randall Cobb and Golden Tate and Julian Edelman and Jarvis Landry, among others, that the Poole would get exposed more often than not. But I don't think that was really the case. But there certainly were several metrics this past season that indicated Poole was a weakness in the secondary in terms of completion percentage allowed. Brian Poole was dead last among the 124 cornerbacks charted by Pro Football Focus in giving up 84% completion rate. And Poole was also the highest among the team's top 4 cornerbacks, including Collins and Alford and Trufant, last year in terms of completion rate, but it was only 66%. I think last year Poole didn't give up very many big plays because he was actually 8th best cornerback in the league in terms of yards allowed per snap and 18th best in terms of yards per target last year. And so when Poole was giving up receptions last year, it was a lot more dink and dunk stuff. It was a lot of short stuff. And it was one of the reasons why we talked about Poole being a really good zone corner, because when he can keep things in front of him, he's very good at sort of limiting gains and stopping the ball. And from a statistical standpoint, 2016, in a lot of metrics, particularly those I just cited, Poole was considered one of the better nickel cornerbacks in the league. But one of the things that changed notably from last year to this year was, besides the completions given up, was the amount of times that he was targeted and how fewer of those targets were contested. This year, Poole was the 17th most targeted cornerback in the league among these 124 guys that I have been citing earlier. Last year, he was the 13th least targeted cornerback on a per-snap basis. And last year, Poole was much better at getting his hands on footballs and breaking up passes. He broke up 10 passes last year. This year, he only broke up 5, which in terms of the number, the percentage of contested throws he had this year among his targets, he had the 5th lowest contested targets among those 124 cornerbacks charted. So you could certainly make a strong case that Poole, you know, in terms of some of the lack of interceptions, the high percentage of completions given up, that sort of, you know, bumped the Falcons' defensive passer rating from being what in a lot of other metrics should have been a top 5, top 10 unit to being a little bit middle of the pack and slightly below average. A lot of that probably had to do with sort of the amount of plays that Poole gave up and the amount of passes that he did not sort of contest. You know, obviously Trufant and Alford didn't have a lot of picks, but they were able to contest a lot of throws, and Poole had no interceptions and contested very few. So I want to make this clear. I don't want to act like I'm throwing Brian Poole on the bus. I think Brian Poole is an underrated player, but I think it goes back to what I was saying, I think, in the offensive line review, when we talk about the notion of a need versus a want. The Falcons don't need to upgrade their cornerback play, their nickel cornerback play, because they arguably have a top 5 secondary with Poole. So they don't necessarily have a huge need at the position. However, I think they do have a want at the position, because some of the areas where they don't look like a top 5 corner secondary, they could certainly become so more so if they upgraded that nickel cornerback play, as well as, you know, they would go from a team that is arguably a top 5 secondary potentially to a team that is, certainly hands down considered the best secondary in the league if they can get a significant uptick in play from the nickel cornerback. And so I think that's what makes it more of a want than a need. But certainly relative to some other wants on the team, I think there's clearly an advantage to making that upgrade, just because when you play in this man-heavy scheme, it allows you to be a little bit more aggressive in terms of what you can do up front. And so in those weeks when the pass rush, when the Falcons aren't able to get pressure with just 4 guys, being able to bring in extra rushers, a 5th guy, 6th guy, is very advantageous, particularly when you're able to sort of hold your own on the back end in man coverage, because when you blitz, you have to play a lot of man. And we talked about this throughout the offseason when it came to Poole, and you know, you look at his lack of height being about a 5'9 and a half, not having ideal speed, running about, what, like a 4.55, 4.6 sort of speed, maybe even slower, if I'm not mistaken. That's not necessarily what you would draw up in terms of the type of cornerback that you would think is ideally suited to play in a man-heavy scheme like the Falcons. And it's one of the reasons why I've always sort of felt that Brian Poole, ever since we signed him as an undrafted free agent, that he was a better fit as a safety in the scheme. And I think, you know, given what we saw this past season, where the Falcons like to have, you know, showed a little bit more versatility in terms of bringing that single high guy, in this case, Ricardo Allen, into the box to play some slot corner a lot more than they had in 2016. I think Poole, obviously, because of his experience playing man coverage, because of his physicality against the run, again, this is not a slight at Rico Allen in any case, but in a lot of ways, you could argue that if Poole was being considered a legitimate safety in the scheme, in a lot of ways, he would be better than Ricardo Allen. Maybe not necessarily in the instincts and whatnot, but certainly there would be little to no drop-off in terms of starter to backup potentially. And of course, you also have a guy like DeMonte Casey. So the Falcons are pretty good at the free safety spot, but the nickel cornerback spot, there are some questions in regard to that. And in truth, when you actually consider it, where Poole has been, I think it's also a testament to Brian Poole. So again, not to throw him under the bus, and I think this is more something that's praising of him. But in reality, when you think about it, probably the number one reason why Brian Poole is currently the Falcons' nickel cornerback is because of the issues that Jalen Collins has gone through over the last 2 years, where Poole has basically been a very effective stopgap for the team the last 2 years. But if Collins hadn't have been such a knucklehead, he should have, without the suspension in 2016 and as well again in 2017, he should have been the nickel cornerback. And I don't think that necessarily, I think Poole has been able to step in, but I think now the Falcons may be in the position where they can replace that long-term guy, because now that they know Collins is no longer a factor. And it sounds like a slight, because many people sort of look at this player with a negative lens, but the player I compared Poole to last season was Bobby McClain, in the sense that my expectation was, due to some of the physical limitations that Poole has, that McClain also had, I thought after that first year in which they were playing nickel and they played particularly well, Bobby Mack in 2012 and Poole in 2016, my expectation was that there were going to be diminishing returns moving forward with Brian Poole, in the same way that we saw with McClain in 2013 and then ultimately culminating in the 2014 season, where the Falcons wound up bringing in the likes of Javier Arenas and Josh Wilson and Ricardo Allen to push McClain for his roster spot. And it resulted in Wilson, I think, by the end of that season being the nickel cornerback guy. And I think you can make the case that that's where the Falcons are potentially headed this offseason. Now, especially now that Collins and C.J. Goodwin are gone, two players that 12 months ago we were looking at this cornerback position with a lot more optimism and hope for the future because of how much young talent they had. But now both of those guys are gone, and you couple that with sort of Poole's stagnation in 2017. And so now you're looking at sort of cornerback being a significant need moving forward. There's a possibility the Falcons bring back Deji Olatoye, to be back in the mix as well. But given how often they've sort of been unwilling to commit to him over the last, 4 or 5 months, I don't necessarily think you could look at him as as strong a option to sort of push Poole going into 2018. And so I think you look at the template maybe potentially that the Broncos set a couple of years ago when they had Aqib Talib and Chris Harris as their number one and number two corners, and then they wound up using a number one pick on Bradley Roby, I think in that 2014 draft. And, Roby has been one of the most expensive, as you might call it, nickel cornerbacks in the league, based off of where he was picked. But given that defensive scheme that Denver plays, which is a man-heavy scheme that is very aggressive with their blitzes up front, it sort of makes a lot of sense to prioritize having, three really strong nickel cornerbacks that can survive man coverage. And so I think, it begs the question with the Falcons, at least, or, when last year they went from more zone to man coverage as the season wore on, but it did appear that the opposite was true this past season. Now, I didn't get the opportunity to chart as many games or the last couple of games as I wanted to prior to recording this, but it did seem like, particularly in the playoffs, the Falcons were playing a lot more cover three zone than they were earlier in the season. And based off of my memory, it seemed like their switch more to zone heavy scheme would have probably occurred right around the time of that Minnesota game, when both Poole and Trufant were out of the lineup for significant portions and the Falcons went to more zone heavy. And so my suspicion is after that, when Trufant and Poole were healthy, the Falcons, didn't necessarily just go full bore back into their man-heavy scheme and went more into sort of zone and saving the man for sort of the third and mediums and third and longs. So I think the Falcons certainly before, before they move forward at the position, they have to figure out, okay, do they want to be more of a zone heavy team? Do they want to be more of a man heavy team? Or do they want to be a balance of both? And I think where they decide upon that scale or that spectrum will determine how high they draft a cornerback. I think that you can be pretty confident at this point that cornerback will be a position that they try to address this offseason to shore up their depth beyond Brian Poole. But sort of, you know, there's one reality where they might use a number one pick on that, depending on how the draft goes. There's another reality where they might wait until the third or fourth round to draft that player as well, maybe even the fifth round if the draft goes a certain way. But I would be very surprised if the Falcons don't use one of their first three or four picks on a cornerback at this point. We'll see, you know, obviously how the rest of the offseason goes. But I think it's important that the Falcons address those spots because you look at the back half of their depth is no longer as promising as I mentioned before when Goodwin and Collins were there. You now have Bleedy Ray Wilson as the de facto number four cornerback. I think Bleedy Ray is fine in that role. I don't think he's ideal. I think he played reasonably well this season, particularly when the Falcons focusing more on the zone coverage than the man-heavy scheme earlier in the season. He can play special teams. He has experience being a nickel cornerback. He has experience being a fourth corner. But I think ideally he's more of a fifth corner than a fourth corner for this team. The same can be said of Leon McFadden, who's sort of a smaller, undersized guy, has spent the bulk of his career playing special teams, and what little opportunities he's had to play defense over his career, he's been okay, competent, maybe below average in a lot of ways. But, you know, he's also a free agent. My assumption is that he will be allowed to walk. Maybe the Falcons decide to offer him a veteran minimum contract or whatever the case may be. I do expect Bleedy Ray to come back, presumably that he doesn't cost too much money. I don't necessarily imagine his contract will be significantly more than what we gave, you know, Phillip Adams a couple of years ago, which was a veteran minimum, maybe with a small signing bonus or something like that. You also have Deontay Burton in the mix, who was an undrafted rookie wide receiver this past summer. The Falcons sort of switched him to cornerback, similar to what they did with C.J. Goodwin 2 years ago. We'll see if Burton sort of makes the leap that Goodwin sort of made from 2015 to 2016 after, you know, spending 2015 on the practice squad and then getting the opportunity to play in 2016 in a large part, again, due to Jalen Collins' suspension. You know, I'm not going to necessarily hold my breath that Deontay Burton's going to do that, but we'll see. You know, he's got the size and he's a decent athlete. So we'll see what he can bring to the table, but I don't necessarily expect the Falcons to go into this off season expecting Deontay Burton, to be a significant part of their solution at cornerback, moving forward. You know, and I think, you know, this was sort of the opposite of the argument I made when we talked about the wide receivers, which is the Falcons, you know, the third wide receiver in this offense doesn't get that much playing time, maybe 50-55% of the snaps, really, most games. But when you look at a player like Brian Poole, when you take out the two games, the Tampa Bay game and that Minnesota game where he was injured and thus his playing time was limited in both those games, in the other 16 games the Falcons played, including the postseason, Brian Poole wound up playing almost exactly 70% of the snaps. So, you know, that's a higher percentage of the snaps defensively than what Adrian Claiborne and Vic Beasley played. So certainly I think it's very clear that the nickel cornerback is a critical component of the Falcons defense. And, you know, really you're thinking about 12 starters on your defense, than necessarily the normal 11. And in reality, your nickel cornerback is more of a starter than whoever that third linebacker is in the Falcons case, Duke Riley. So, you know, again, I think the expectations of the Falcons will probably use a day two, probably pick on a cornerback at this point in time is probably a safe assumption at this point. You know, there's a chance that they could go after a veteran. I don't, you know, cornerbacks are a relatively expensive position. So any competent veteran that you could get that you would think is a clear upgrade over Brian Poole is probably not going to be cheap unless he's like a Tremont Williams type of guy that's like 34 years old and looking for one last run. And then you can sort of get those guys on relatively cheap deals. But other than that, I think if the Falcons probably best case scenario is probably waiting until the draft, especially when you consider that Robert Alford is 29 years old and his contract is such, though, that the Falcons are able to move on from him after this 2018 season, should there be any sort of significant drop off from him at age 30. You know, I don't expect that to happen, but especially coming off of this past year. But certainly, you know, Alford has a tendency to be a little bit more up and down than normal. So who knows? And I don't think you could necessarily consider Poole to be a replacement for Alford. So even though I spent the bulk of this talking about, you know, upgrading over Brian Poole, it would not surprise me at all that even if the Falcons use like a second round pick on a cornerback next year, that Brian Poole still remains the cornerback. I do think he's a competitor and he's going to be tough to sort of unseat in this role, especially given that for the most part over the last 2 years, we've gotten solid to good play from him. But I certainly think there's room for upgrade, room for improvement there. And I do expect the Falcons to at least make an attempt to upgrade that position this offseason. So we're going to talk more and wrap up this roster review by talking special teams, of course, right here on the Locked On Falcons podcast. All right, so when we talk about special teams, you know, I think the major issue, at least when it comes to this offseason, is whether the Falcons are going to bring back Matt Bryant. You got Josh Harris, a long snapper. He signed through 2018, has been solid these last couple of years, basically ever since his rookie year in 2011, 2012, whenever that was. He's been pretty lights out. Matt Bosher is signed through 2019, and, you know, he's not going anywhere. You could probably nitpick and say instead of the one normal bad game that Bosher has almost every year, he had like two this year. But again, it's nitpicking. You know, you can say, oh, well, his kickoffs weren't as good as they were the last couple of years. But again, I think some of that is due to injuries and, again, nitpicking. The same applies to Matt Bryant. You can say, oh, well, this wasn't his best season and he missed a couple of kicks and he had a couple of kicks blocked. But again, I think that's nitpicking. I think Matt Bryant certainly over the course of the entire year showed that he still has that ability to kick in the clutch. You know, you can make a case that maybe the gap between his consistency at home versus his consistency on the road is widening, but I still think most of the metrics, based off what I recall seeing, still indicate that he's a pretty good kicker away from the dome, and he's not necessarily a guy that's, you know, surviving because he's so accurate at home and then becomes very mediocre on the road. I don't think that's the case at all, but I'd have to double check the numbers to see that. My expectation is Bryant will be re-signed. To me, the bigger question is that whether or not he's going to want to, you know, how he's going to want his contract structured. Is it basically going to be like, I'll just sign a one-year deal and we'll figure it out in 2019 if I want to come back? Or do I sign a multi-year deal that allows the team some sort of wiggle room in 2019 if he decides to hang it up or whatnot? So, I mean, that to me is the major decision they have to make with Matt Bryant. It's like, you know, as a contract situation. And regardless, you're still going to pay him, you know, $3, $4 million this year or whatever the number is. And you're going to feel like that's worth it and until it's not, you know. And so Matt Bryant, this could be the last year that Matt Bryant's a Falcon, or he could play another 3 years. Who knows? At this point in time, I'm good either way, and we'll just keep chugging along in this train, and I'll worry about the future of that kicker position until it's very clear that Matt Bryant will no longer be the Falcons kicker. You know, I think the other issues, the real issues that the Falcons are going to have to address on their special teams unit is the questionable play of the coverage units and the questionable return game. As I said when we discussed the wide receiver position several days ago, I don't expect the team to re-sign Andre Roberts, who is a free agent. We'll see if the Falcons make a concerted effort to get another return specialist in here this offseason, as they've done the last two offseasons with Roberts a year ago and then Devin Fuller 2 years ago. Based off of that trend, it does seem like it's likely that if the Falcons should, you know, draft a running back, wide receiver, or cornerback this April, all of which seem like possibilities, that player will also potentially double as a return specialist to enhance that group. I don't necessarily know if the Falcons will go out of their way to sign a guy specific to return. I don't think that's really necessary. As I said in the wide receiver conversation and review, I think you can, between Marvin Hall, Reggie Davis, and Nick Williams, all of whom are under contract for next season, you can be reasonably confident that via camp competition, one of those guys will be able to emerge as your return specialist and sort of stabilize that, you know, either that wide receiver four, wide receiver five position that Roberts and Weems have sort of filled the last couple of years. You know, none of those guys are necessarily, I would sit here and be like, oh yeah, those guys are going to be superstar return guys, but I don't think you necessarily need that. I just don't think really in this day and age, teams are really helping themselves out by investing significant resources in their return specialists. And for me, at least, you know, the way I sort of look at it, with sort of not getting a full return on their investment with Devin Fuller and Andre Roberts, I think somewhat vindicates that viewpoint, just because the team is trying to get these guys and they're getting significantly less in return from what they end. I just think the change in the evolution is that you just saw, oh, we don't need to invest as much in those positions and we'll likely get more on the return than what we're investing in it. And so, you know, you just look around the league and you see how many kickoffs and punts are actually returned nowadays, just because, you know, the rules basically limit the number of kickoffs that are taken out of the end zone. And then punters are so good nowadays that they can really, you know, cough and corner you. And so even if you do have a good return specialist, like the chances of him being as impactful as you would hope he was is lower, because teams are going to then actually kick away from him. So the better he is, the less impact he has on the game, which I think is sort of one of the reasons why I just don't understand why teams continually invest significant resources in this position group, and including the Falcons. Now, it's not to sit there and say that if, you know, not having a player that's good back there is not worthwhile, but I just think investing resources in guys that are just return specialists doesn't make a lot of sense. And, you know, initially I was skeptical of the team signing Andre Roberts because that was my expectation. But then I sort of was like, oh, well, they'll use him as the fifth wide receiver and he'll add some value on offense. And so that will basically indicate, you know, that it's not as bad a signing. But then the Falcons basically, I think he played like, what, 20 snaps on offense the whole year. And so you're not getting anything out of it. You know, so like, for example, I think if you're going to draft a guy, like if you draft an Adoree Jackson, that makes perfect sense because he can come in and give you value as a starter, either as a nickel or as a starting cornerback. But on top of that, he can also return kicks. You know, but if you have a guy that's only value is return specialist, then I think you're really sort of setting him up to fail. Roberts, you know, for the most part was league average. In terms of his kickoff returns, the average kickoff return this past season in the NFL was 21.6 yards. He hit 22.6, so he's a yard better. The average punt return was 8.2 yards. Roberts was slightly below that, was 7.4 yards per return. You look at the number of punt returns that went for 20-plus yards this year. There was 80 of those over the course of the entire season league-wide, which amounted to about 7.5% of all punts. Roberts had one of those on his 27 punt returns, so 3.7%. So basically, if he had been average, he would have had two 20-plus yard returns instead of one. Roughly 3.7% of all kickoffs this year went for 40-plus yards on the return. Roberts had two, which is about 5.3%, so slightly better than average. But even when you look at both the combined number of 40-plus yard kickoff returns and 20-plus yard punt returns, the best returner in the league this year, the LA Rams, Farrell Cooper, had 11 of those combined returns. An average returner in his position should have had, based off of the number of returns he had, should have had four this year. So you look at a guy like Farrell Cooper, and he was basically plus seven in terms of the number of drives that he was able to give the Rams more favorable field position than the average returner. But over the course of an entire season where you have 180-some-odd possessions, that really only results in like a 3% boost. And so that's part of the reason why I just don't necessarily get why you would invest. Like, you know, not to say that a 3% boost is nothing, but, you know, why are you throwing millions of dollars or draft picks that's something that at best is going to be a 3% boost to your offense. And in all likelihood, you're talking about like 1% boost to your offense. And so I just think it's a better strategy for you to go after guys like the Falcons have done in recent years with Bernard Reedy, J.D. McKissic, Reggie Davis, Marvin Hall, these sort of undrafted free agents that you bring to camp. And between them, oftentimes you'll get somebody who is at least a viable NFL return guy, and sort of you don't feel the need that, oh man, we just guaranteed, you know, like in the case of Andre Roberts, we guaranteed $700,000 to this guy, and so we can't get rid of him. Or in the case of Devin Fuller, we drafted him in the seventh round, and so we can't get rid of him. And one of the reasons why a guy like J.D. McKissic isn't on the team is in Seattle is for those very reasons. One of the reasons why Reggie Davis, you know, was on the practice squad as opposed to the active roster is for those reasons, because the Falcons had invested their resources in other players and therefore couldn't necessarily turn the keys to arguably the better option there. So, you know, it's not to say that the Falcons shouldn't draft a return specialist. I just think you shouldn't draft a guy that is just a return specialist. You need to draft a guy that has upside on either offense or defense, that he's over the course of his 4 years when you draft him has the potential or the likelihood to rise up the depth chart based off of his offensive and defensive prowess, as opposed to a guy that's going to live and die by whether or not he's an above average to good return specialist, which again, only a handful of guys in the league really sort of qualifies that. As far as the coverage goes, and we'll wrap it up here by talking about the coverage and the need to improvement. My suspicion is that, you know, with several of the Falcons' day three draft picks, several of those guys will be able to come in and help enhance the coverage units and be asked to play there. The Falcons gave up the league-leading 26.2 yards per kickoff. They gave up 8.1 yards per punt return, which was 13th highest in the league as well. I think many people have blamed Keith Armstrong for that. I certainly have counted myself among the Keith Armstrong defenders. I don't think by any means he's perfect. You know, I'm still baffled by the whole Nick Williams decision, but maybe it had to do with Justin Hardy being hurt, or Marvin Hall's drop pass in terms of Nick Williams playing gunner at the end of the year. He was not good in that role, but, you know, apparently Nick Williams is a good luck charm, because when he was in that role, the Falcons managed to get two muffed punt return fumbles. So Nick Williams, you know, he's so scrappy, I guess. But I do think a lot of the drop-off the last couple of years has been, and particularly this year, I think they had so many fresh faces playing special teams this year. You had guys like Jermaine Grace, Duke Riley, Teron Ward, Eric Saubert, Marvin Hall, DeMonte Casey, Bleedy Ray, Derek Coleman, among others, that were all relative, if not brand new to the special teams unit, had been only seen limited reps over the last couple of years since they've been on the team. So you had a pretty much new group. And so basically going back to last year, the only guys that were really returners were Kamal Ishmael, Levine Toilolo, Brooks Reed, CJ Goodwin, Justin Hardy, and Leroy Reynolds. And of course, you got to remember Goodwin was cut midway through the season. Hardy was basically removed from playing special teams after that Seahawks game. And Reynolds basically missed the first 7 games of the year. So you really, your continuity on special teams was Kamal Ishmael, Levine Toilolo, and Brooks Reed pretty much this year. So I do think that's a big factor in why the special teams has sort of steadily been declining, because I do think you've had diminishing continuity. You lost Justin Hardy, you lost Warlow, you lost Weems, Goodwin, DeMarco, Josh Perkins from last year's special teams units, essentially, not to mention guys like Corey Bierman, Nate Stupar, Robinson Therese, and Antone Smith over the last couple of years since Dan Quinn has been in town that you've lost. I also think another thing that factors into it is the fact that guys like Deion Jones and Devondre Campbell, some of these young defensive players, in Brian Poole, you can also throw in that conversation as well, guys that normally would have played special teams over the last year or two have been forced to play so much on defense as starters. And I think that's somewhat depleted the quality of the special teams units. And of course, you know, that's not a bad thing. Obviously what has been the special teams loss is the defense's gain. But I do think when you talk about sort of the causality of, you know, not having necessarily some of the best, you know, some of the players that would have been the best options on special teams are also some of the best players on defense as well. And so you're losing some of that and being basically forced to put in some sort of replacement level players on special teams. And again, obviously the trade-off is you're not allowing replacement level players to play on defense, as the Falcons often did from 2014 to 2015. But that's a conversation for another day. So it'll be interesting to see if the Falcons cater their day three picks to some guys that can help out on special teams. Any running backs, wide receivers, tight ends, linebackers, or cornerbacks, or safeties the Falcons do draft on day three, and several of those positions are possibilities for the Falcons to target then, probably will be expected to play special teams roles this year. You also hope that many of the guys that should be returning that were brand new to the team last year, like Duke Riley, like Saubert, like Teron Ward, like Casey, like Hall, etc., will be improved now that they have a little bit more experience playing special teams under their belt. You know, as far as free agency goes, there's a possibility that the Falcons, particularly maybe if they wanted to address their linebacker depth, maybe potentially replace a guy like Ishmael or Reynolds, depending on the circumstances, may target some guys that might have a little bit more value as special teams guys than necessarily guys that have a ton of value on defense. That'll be an interesting thing to look for. And basically, you know, they'll be looking for a Nate Stupar type of player, ideally, in that regard. But we'll see how it goes. I don't expect the team to really sort of address their special teams in free agency. But you do wonder if it's going to be a priority this offseason, with Dan Quinn saying in his postseason press conference that they was going to take a larger role in special teams this upcoming season. And so you do wonder if they will make a concerted effort to enhance their roster in their training camp competition by getting guys specifically that are a little bit more proven on special teams, or guys that have, you know, had a built more of a reputation being high level special teams players as well. You know, you look at the decline over the last couple of years, and you can draw a correspondence between sort of their limited investment in sort of enhancing their special teams and more of their focus on enhancing their offense and defense over the last couple of off seasons, as opposed, and it hasn't necessarily trickled down to their special teams. So, you know, it'll be a big question to see if they reverse that and go more for their depth than necessarily trying to enhance their starting position. Because one of the positive things you can say about the Falcons, and one of the things that you probably guys glean from listening, if you listen to this entire 6-hour series, is that the Falcons don't have a ton of needs in terms of their starting lineups. If you're asking me to sort of summarize it all, now that you're 6 hours into it, I would look at fullback and D-tackle being the two real needs on the team in terms of starters. I think you can say nickel cornerback. I think you can say right guard are more wants that they need at the starting spots. I think they need to address their wide receiver depth. I think they can certainly address their tight end depth. I certainly think linebacker depth is a position that can be addressed as well. And so I would probably look at those seven spots as probably the primary areas that I of concern heading into this offseason for the Falcons. You can sort of rank them in any sort of order. It doesn't really matter to me. But yeah, those would be the seven areas that I would suspect that the team should address. And, you know, presumably if you can address the fullback position in free agency, then you can leave those other six spots to address potentially in the draft, where the Falcons have six picks, thanks to the Sambrelo trade. They're missing a fifth round pick this year. So, you know, that's one sort of easy sort of cookie cutter place, but we'll see. This certainly won't be the last time we talk about the Falcons roster in 2017, as well as their outlook for 2018. We'll continue to talk about needs and free agency stuff as we get closer. This upcoming week, we're going to do year-end awards. So this, you know, that will be sort of our final cap to the 2017 season. If you guys have any suggestions on sort of some out there awards rather than the sort of traditional ones that you would expect on this, and you've come used to hearing us talk about in previous award episodes on this podcast, then by all means, send in your suggestions. If you have them on Twitter, you can send them to me at Falcfans. If it's podcast related, just let me know in the tweet. But otherwise, you can just send it over to Locked On Falcons. That's the show's Twitter handle, and that way I will know it's podcast-related. You can also send an email at lockedonfalcons@mail.com. Facebook, where there are no Twitter character limits, the Facebook page is Locked On Falcons. Give us a like while you're there. You can also post a comment on falfans.com as well as lockedonfalcons.com, where the show is posted daily. This upcoming weekend, I will try to do a leftover mailbag. We've gotten a lot of questions over the last couple of weeks that I haven't addressed that have been more off-season related questions. In these last 2 weeks, we haven't really posted anything at Locked On Falcons. So I'll try to change that this upcoming week with the Super Bowl coming on. We'll talk about the Super Bowl. We'll talk about my thoughts on that, and maybe I'll get a guest or two to come in and give their thoughts on the Super Bowl. Or maybe we can get something from the Locked On Eagles guys or the Locked On Patriots guys, what their expectations are from that upcoming game, as well as other people on the Locked On Podcast Network. So you guys stay locked on, and we'll be back later this week. I don't know exactly what day. Talk more Falcons, talk more NFL, talk more draft, all that type of stuff. So stay locked on.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily Atlanta Falcons podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.